From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
The Calling Card by Ramsey Campbell. Dorothy Harris stepped off the pavement and into her hall. As she stooped, groaning to pick up the envelopes, the front door opened, a yawn that wouldn't be suppressed. She wrestled it shut. She must ask Simon to see to it, though certainly not over Christmas. Then she began to open the cards. Here was Father Christmas, and here he was again, apparently after dieting. Here was a robin like a rosy apple with a beak, and here was an envelope whose handwriting staggered. Simon's and Marjorie's children, perhaps? The card showed a church on a snowy hill. The hill was bare except for a smudge of ink. Though the card was unsigned, there was writing within. A very happy Christmas and a prosperous New Year, the message would have said. But now it said a very harried Christmas and no New Year. She turned back to the picture, her hands shaking. It wasn't just a smudge of ink. Someone had drawn a smeary cross on the hill, a grave. Though the name on the envelope was a watery blur, the address was certainly hers. Suddenly the house, the kitchen and living room, the two bedrooms, with their memories stacked neatly against the walls, seemed far too large and dim. Without moving from the front door, she phoned Marjorie. "Is it Grandma?" Marjorie had to hush the children while she said, "You come as soon as you like, Mummy." Lark Lane was deserted. An unsold Christmas tree loitered in the shop doorway. A gargoyle's craned out from the police station. Once Marjorie had moved away, the nearness of the police had been reassuring. Not that Dorothy was nervous like some of the old folks these days, but the police station was only a community center now. The bus already sounded like a pub. She sat outside on the ferry, though the bench looked and felt like black ice. Lights fished in the Mersey, gulls drifted down like snowflakes from the muddy sky. A whitish object grabbed the rail, but of course, it was only a gull. Nevertheless, she was glad that Simon was waiting with a car at Woodside. As soon as the children had been packed off to bed so that Father Christmas could get to work, she produced the card. It felt wet, almost slimy, though it hadn't before. Simon pointed out that what she'd overlooked, the age of the stamp. "We weren't even living there then," Marjorie said. "You wouldn't think they would bother delivering it after 60 years.
A touch of the Christmas spirit?
"I wish they hadn't bothered," Marjorie said. But her mother didn't mind now. The addressee must have died years ago. She turned the conversation to old times, to Marjorie's father. Later she gazed from her bedroom window at the houses of Bevington sleeping in pairs. A man was creeping about the house. But it was only Simon laden with presents. In the morning, the house was full of cries of delight, gleaming new toys, balls of wrapping paper big as cabbages. In the afternoon, the adults, bulging with turkey and pudding, lolled in chairs. When Simon drove her home that night, Dorothy noticed that the unsold Christmas tree was still there, a scrawny, glistening shape at the back of the shop doorway. As soon as Simon left, she found herself thinking about the unpleasant card. She tore it up, then went determinedly to bed. Boxing Day was her busiest time. What with cooking the second version of Christmas dinner and making sure the house was impeccable and hiding small presents for the children to find, she wished she could see them more often, but they and their parents had their own lives to lead. An insect clung to a tinsel globe on the tree. When she reached out to squash the insect, that wasn't there, neither on the globe nor on the floor. Could it have been the reflection of someone thin outside that window? Nobody was there now. She liked the house best when it was full of laughter, and it would be again soon. "We'll get a sitter," Marjorie promised, "and first foot you on New Year's Eve." She used to do that when she had lived at home. She'd wait outside at midnight of the old year,
so as to be the first to cross her mother's threshold. That reminded Dorothy to offer the children a holiday treat. Everything seemed fine, even when they went to the door to leave. "Grandma, someone's left you a present," little Denise cried. Then she cried out and dropped the package. Perhaps the wind had snatched it from her hands. As the package, which looked wet and moldy, struck the curb, it broke open. Did its contents scuttle out and sidle away into the dark? Surely that was the play of the wind, which tumbled carton and wrappings away down the street. Someone must have used her doorway for a waste bin, that was all. Dorothy lay in bed listening to the wind, which groped around the windowless side of the house that faced onto the alley. She kept thinking. She was on the ferry, backing away from the rail, forgetting that the rail was also behind her. Her nervousness annoyed her. She was acting like an old fogey, which was why next afternoon she walked to Otterspool Promenade. Gulls and planes sailed over the Mersey, which was deserted except for boys. On the far bank, tiny towns and stalks of factory chimneys stood at the foot of an enormous frieze of clouds. Sunlight slipped through to Birkenhead and Walsey, touching up the colors of microscopic streets, speck of windows glinted. She enjoyed none of this, for the slopping of water beneath the promenade seemed to be pacing her. Worse, she couldn't make herself go to the rail to prove that there was nothing. Really, it was heartbreaking. One vicious card and she felt nervous in her own house. A blurred voice seemed to creep behind the carols on the radio, lowing out of tune. Next day, she took her washing to Lark Lane, in search of distraction as much as anything. The Westinghouse laundromat was deserted. 000, the washing machine said emptily. There was only herself and her dervishes of clothes in a plastic bag almost as tall as she was. If someone had abandoned it, whatever its lumpy contents were, she could see why, for it was leaking. She smelled stagnant water. It must be a draught that made it twitch feebly. Nevertheless, if she had been able to turn off her machine, she might have fled. She mustn't grow neurotic. She still had friends to visit. The following day, she went to a friend whose flat overlooked Wavertree Park. It was all very convivial. A rainstorm outside made the mince pies more warming. The chat flowed as easily as the whiskey, but she kept glancing at the thin figure who stood in the park, unmoved by the downpour. The trails of rain on the windows must be lending him their color, for his skin looked like a snail's. Eventually, the 68 bus, meandering like a drunkard's monologue, took her home to Eigsberth. No, the man in the park hadn't really looked as though his clothes and his body had merged into a single grayish mass. Tomorrow she was taking the children for the retreat, and that would clear her mind. She took them to the aquarium. Piranhas sank stonily, their sides glittering like Christmas cards. Toads were bubbling lumps of tar. Finny humbugs swam in darting fish wired with light. Had one of the tanks cracked. There seemed to be a stagnant smell. In the museum, everything was under glass. Shrunken heads like sewn leathery handbags. A watchmaker's workshop. Buses passing as though the windows were silent films. Here was a slum street walled in by photographs of despair. Real flagstones underfoot, overhung by street lamps on brackets. She halted between a grid and a drinking fountain. She was trapped in the dimness between blind corners and couldn't see either way. Why couldn't she get rid of the stagnant smell? Gray, forlorn faces, pressed like specimens, peered out of the walls. "Come on, quickly," she said, pretending that only the children were nervous. She was glad of the packed crowds in Church Street, even though the children kept letting go of her hands. But the stagnant smell was trailing her, and once when she grabbed for little Denise's hand, she clutched someone else's, which felt soft and wet. It must have been nervousness, which made her fingers seem to sink into the hand. That night she returned to the aquarium and found she was locked in. Except for the glow of the tanks, the narrow room was oppressively dark. In the nearest tank, a large dead fish floated toward her out of weeds. Now she was in the tank, her nails scrabbling at the glass, and she saw that it wasn't a fish, but a snail-colored hand which closed spongily on hers. When she awoke, her scream made the house sound very empty. At least it was New Year's Eve. After tonight, she could stop worrying. Why had she thought that? It only made her more nervous. Even when Marjorie phoned to confirm they would foot first her, that reminded her how many hours she would be on her own. As the night seeped into the house, the emptiness grew. A knock at the front door made her heart start. But it was only the Harveys inviting her next door for sherry and sandwiches. While she dodged the sudden rainstorm, Mr. Harvey dragged at her front door, one hand through the letterbox, until the latch clicked. After several sherries, Dorothy remembered something she'd once heard. The lady who lived next door before me. Didn't she have trouble with her son? He wasn't right in the head. He got so he'd go for anyone, even if he'd never met them before. She got so scared of him, she locked him out one New Year's Eve. They say he threw himself in the river, though they never found the body. Dorothy wished she hadn't asked. She thought of the body rotting in the depths. She must go home, in case Simon and Marjorie arrived. The Harveys were next door if she needed them. The sherries had made her sleepy. Only the ticking of her clock, clipping away the hands, kept her awake. 11:20. The splashing from the gutter sounded like wet footsteps pacing outside the window. She had never noticed she could smell the river in her house. She wished she had stayed longer with the Harveys. She would have been able to hear Simon's car. 11:20. Surely they wouldn't wait until midnight. She switched on the radio for company. A master of ceremonies was making people laugh. A man was laughing thickly, sounding waterlogged. Was he a drunk in the street? He wasn't on the radio. She mustn't brood. Why? She hadn't put out the sherry glasses. That was something to do, to distract her from the intolerably measured counting of the clock, the silenced radio, the emptiness displaying her sounds. Though the knock seemed enormously loud, she didn't start. They were here at last, though she hadn't heard the car. It was New Year's Day. She ran, and had reached the front door when the phone shrilled. That startled her so badly that she snatched the door open before lifting the receiver. Nobody was outside, only a distant uproar of cheers and bells and horns. And Marjorie was on the phone. "We've been held up, Mummy. There was an accident in the tunnel. We'll be over as soon as we can." Then who had knocked? It must have been a drunk. She heard him stumbling beside the house, thumping on her window. He'd better take himself off, or she would call Mr. Harvey to deal with him. But she was still inside the doorway when she saw the object on her step. Good God, was it a rat? No, just a shoe, so ancient that it looked stuffed with mold. It wasn't mold, only a rotten old sock. There was something in the sock, something that smelled of stagnant water and worse. She stooped to peer at it, and then she was struggling to close the door, fighting to make the latch click. No breath to spare for a scream. She'd had her first foot, and now, hobbling doggedly alongside the house, its hands slithering over the wall, here came the rest of the body. The Feet by Mark Channing. Am I, Richard Haldane Bullen, King's Counsel and Officer of the Crown, a murderer? Hear the facts and judge for yourself. I liked my Uncle Harvey very much. People who didn't know him well thought him queer. Many collectors of Oriental curios are queer sort of people. Haven't you found that? It is as if something crept out of their curios to inhabit their mind and made them harmless Jekylls and Hydes. They ceased to be normal whenever the materialism of the West is overcome by that mysterious something which seems to exude from almost all Eastern things. My Uncle Harvey, however, was queer in a strange way. He was afraid of his curios. They dominated his existence. The fact that most of them were gruesome relics made this fairly reasonable. I've studied enough psychology to know that. Anyway, I was down from Oxford for the Christmas vacation, and Uncle Harvey asked me to dine with him. Now, I have always disliked Bloomsbury. I still do. It depresses me. But because I was fond of the old man, and as he had promised to show me his curios, which up to then I had not seen, I accepted the invitation. It was the 22nd of December, I remember, and a damp, foggy night. After dinner, we adjourned to his study, his chamber of horrors, as he laughingly called it. As he opened the door of that room, I sensed this queerness to the point of feeling goose flesh all over. It may, of course, have been because he told me that the somber Indian hangings had come from the Nana Sahib's palace at Cawnpore. General Havelock's Highlanders, he said, had torn them down when they wrecked the palace after discovering that awful well, filled to the brim with the bodies of women and children. Mind you, my uncle's study was a cozy room, but its intimacy was, well, stealthy. It was thug-like. That is, it crept upon you as the Indian thugs used to creep upon their victims, strangling all sense of happiness with a quick overcoming and an instantaneous, merciless domination. As I have said, I was fond of my Uncle Harvey. I want you to remember that. Well, as we entered the room, he switched on the lights inside a large cabinet near the fireplace. It was a Victorian bit of furniture, and its glass doors had tightly pleated green silk curtains behind them. To me, lighted up and closed as it was, it seemed rather like a house that held some grim secret which it wished to conceal. That queerness reached out and literally grabbed me as I opened its doors. My uncle, who was preparing coffee, he always made his own, looked up as he heard the click of the small key. See that big knife with the deep channel running down to its point, Dick? That came from the temple of Kali in southern India. It was used in the sacrificing of babies to the goddess. That tress of hair caked with blood was taken out of the well at Cawnpore after the massacre of 1857. The dingy-looking bit of rope by the side of it. And these, Uncle Harvey? I asked, interrupting him, and taking up one of the two circlets of silver ankle bells. What are these? I shook it lightly. I wanted to change the subject, you see. The bells had a curiously shrill, sweet sound, I remember. For God's sake, put them down, exclaimed Uncle Harvey. I glanced at him in astonishment. Banging down the methylated spirit lamp of the coffee machine onto the hammered brass deli work tray over which he was bending, he strode over to me. You didn't touch those by any chance, did you? He asked harshly, pointing to two tiny wax models of a woman's feet. They were about an inch long. As I looked at them, I saw that the artist had evidently made them to resemble feet which had been recently severed from the leg a few inches above the ankle bone. The shiny redness of the flesh and the whiteness of the splintered bone were horribly realistic. The minute toenails were colored red with henna. Good Lord, no. I hadn't even noticed them, I replied. What's wrong? I asked the question because he looked pale and distraught. Come and have your coffee, Dick, he said gravely, taking me by the arm. This is their story. Somewhere in the 60s, a certain Indian Nawab, who had been forced to leave India on account of his savage cruelty to his people, came to live in England. Being as wealthy as Croesus, he brought over with him his harem and a big staff of servants. He wanted to be received in society, but his reputation for cruelty caused society to boycott him. He lived absolutely isolated from the civilization in which he had taken refuge. Sinister rumors soon got out. Screams of women were heard at night, and it was said that he murdered several of his women servants. Remember, in the days of which I am speaking, an English home was far more a castle than it is today. And as the house was always closely shuttered, nobody knew anything for certain. At all events, no less than 7 skeletons were dug up in the garden some years later. That's his picture hanging over the cabinet you were looking at. Nasty-looking fellow, don't you think? I turned to look at the oil painting. My poor old uncle was right. That picture of a tall, bejeweled Indian with a lean, cruel face of a murderous sadist wasn't the sort of thing I'd care to have in any room of mine. When the Nawab died, or was murdered in his turn, resumed my uncle, what was left of his household returned to India and the house was put up for sale. The first people to buy it had not been there a week before their butler was murdered. All the other servants refused to stay in the house. Its next occupants lost their 2 children inside a week. The poor mites were found lying in the hall with their necks broken. Neither the parents nor the doctors thought it was an accident. How could it have been? Both these tragedies happened within 3 months. After that, the house remained empty. The Nawab's agents, under orders from his successor, had it cleaned every 12 months, but although the rent was nominal, no one could be found to take it. Doubtless because the workmen and charwomen who cleaned the place saw that each time they came they found the prints of a woman's small feet in the dust on the carpetless stairs and also on the marble floor what used to be the women's apartments. They also maintained that they heard sleigh bells jingling down the passages. None of them ever saw anything, though. Now, as my uncle spoke, I distinctly heard the circlet of bells I had been looking at jingle. I think he did, too. I suppose I had it laid down on the edge of its sister anklet, and it had slipped. Well, he went on pretending, I think not to have heard it. Then I took the house, Dick. This house. I took it on certain conditions, though. I said I wanted to live in it a week before I would sign the lease. The agents agreed, and as temporary caretakers, put in an Indian who had married a white woman. They couldn't get a white man to take on the job, they said. Now, as you know, I took over your grandfather's curio business. Then, as now, I believe that strange powers are hidden in certain things, that certain things can be either lucky or unlucky. Well, on the day I was to go into this house, a Lascar, Indian sailor, came to my shop and asked me to buy from him a wax image of a dancing girl. It was a beautiful piece of work. They don't make them anymore. It's a lost art. Sahib, said the Lascar, buy it. It is from the temple of Kali. Whoever has it, or even a part of it, in his possession is under the protection of the goddess. Evil spirits cannot harm him. I bought the thing, and I remember thinking that it would be a good idea to take it with me when I went to try out this house. On the 22nd of December, a year ago today, I arrived with my suitcase. The Indian opened the door. I didn't like the look of him directly I saw him. His eyes had a curious glassy look, which I put down to opium and dismissed him from my mind. I found prepared for me the late Nawab's bedroom, a smallish room with carved sandalwood paneling and doors. Beautiful work. I'll show it to you before you go, if you'd like to see it. It all looked snug and inviting. There was a bright fire burning, and it had been thoroughly cleaned, though, like all other servants of his kind, I found later that of the three carved sandalwood shelves above the mantelpiece, he had only dusted the two bottom ones. But I'm tall, and perhaps he couldn't reach the top one. Well, one of the first things I did was to stand the image of the dancing girl on the table under the lamp while I had supper. I wanted to have a good look at her. I had been too busy to do so before. I had brought a bottle of port and some cold chicken and a couple of books on Eastern mysticism, and to tell the truth, I was rather looking forward to the night. That little statue was almost lifelike, Dick. The enthusiasm of a true collector rang in my uncle's tones. Even to the caste mark on her little forehead, every detail was exact, and the colors were so bright, she might have been made that very day. Now, you may take it from me that I was wide awake as I am now. You may laugh at me if you will, but while I was looking at her, I saw a man's thin brown hand, its fingers covered with gorgeous rings, reach over the table as if it to take away the little figure. Whether I was imagining it or not, I snatched up the statue and thrust it hastily into my breast pocket. As I did so, the hand melted into thin air. That's what comes of reading books on Oriental mysticism, I muttered, and getting up from the table, I settled myself in an inviting-looking easy chair at one side of the fire. For an hour or more, nothing happened. Only rats squeaking and scuttering in the wainscoting and all that. Then I heard, or thought I heard, a faint moaning, but I decided there might quite well be a loose shutter swinging in the wind somewhere. I must have dozed, for I was suddenly awakened by a hand feeling in my breast pocket. Although the lamp was burning brightly, I could see nothing, but I instinctively grabbed at whatever it was, and my fingers closed around a slim, cold wrist. My uncle frowned, and for the first time in my life I saw fear in his eyes. And believe me, to see fear in the eyes of a hard rider to hounds is not a pleasant sight. Port and mysticism aren't good for the imagination, uncle, I said as cheerily as I could and gulped down my coffee. The room was getting on my nerves, as strong as they are. No, Dick, retorted my uncle gravely, it wasn't imagination. It was something my fingers could hold. A damp, soggy, cold wrist, like the wrist of a corpse. But it seemed to slip from my fingers. Then I heard the chinking of a notch girl's ankle bells, faintly on the other side of the door leading into what was the Nawab's harem. Jumping to my feet, I flung open the door, and I found myself looking into the glassy eyes of the Indian caretaker. Did you call, Sahib? He asked, looking at me with those dead, fish-like eyes of his. I did some rapid thinking. I've already told you, Dick, that I'd taken a dislike to the man. I disliked still more finding him where he was at the moment, so I decided to keep him under observation. I bade him come in and sit with me, and he came in. They say this house is haunted, I said, by way of starting a conversation. He was evidently loath to begin. It is true, Sahib, he said. and I have never heard anything colder than his voice. The boot, or spirit, of a young dancing girl is in the house. She was the Nawab's favorite, and she fell in love with a young sahib who saw her at the window one day. They were about to elope when the Nawab caught her. And then I questioned. And he cut off her feet himself and sent them to the young Englishman. My uncle paused a moment and looked towards the cabinet. And then, Dick, I swear, he said to me earnestly, that the chinking of those anklet bells began again in the other room, but much louder. They were coming towards me, whether it was the fog or whether it was that the caretaker hadn't put enough oil in the lamp. I don't know, but at that moment the room grew darker. Slowly the door swung open, and the sound of the anklet bells became shrill and loud. My Uncle Harvey paused and mopped his forehead. Then, Dick, he said tensely, then I saw the feet. As he spoke, it seemed to me that the room became darker. I saw the feet, I say, asseverated my uncle. They seemed to have been severed from the leg just above the ankle, only a few minutes before. You saw those wax ones? Well, they were like that. My uncle shuddered. I wish to God I could forget them. I'd be so much happier. Then he pulled himself together. They passed me and mounted onto the lid of a carved sandalwood chest inlaid with mother of pearl that stood on the opposite side of the fireplace. It's still there. I distinctly saw the fresh blood glisten in the indented hollow behind the ankle bones. Dick, she seemed to be trying to reach something on the topmost of the three shelves. I couldn't speak or move. Then that moaning began again, on the corner where the chest was. By a tremendous effort, I forced myself to look at my companion. He had risen from his chair. No devil in hell could have looked more evil than he did. I sprang up, oversetting the lamp. Siva, Siva, I heard myself screaming in tones as cracked as those of a man of 90. Siva the destroyer is protecting me. You cannot harm me. As I screamed, he sprang at me and I leapt from him. I felt his right hand dart into my breast pocket, seize the statue and drag it out. I only just managed to clutch at its feet, which broke off in my hand. Then I fell and must have stunned myself. When I came to the caretaker, a stout Madrasi was standing at the table with my morning tea. He seemed to think I had lain down on the floor to rest. Master? Well, please excuse, he said, that I did not let him in yesterday, but they told me that you had a key, sahib. Therefore, having put everything ready, I spent the night at the hospital with my wife. She died this morning, sahib. My uncle looked at me, as if he suspected I might be amused at his story, but I wasn't. The misery in his face fairly frightened me. The feet of the statue I found clasped in my hand, he said slowly. There was no trace of the rest of it. As I sit here, Dick, I swear before heaven that I believe those bits of wax are all that stand between me and the evil thing that is still in this house. It may be stupid and all that, but I am convinced that only so long as they are in my possession am I safe. He rose and crossed to the sideboard to mix a Doc and Doris. I made up my mind then and there. This fear complex must be smashed once and forever. If it weren't smashed, I was convinced he would go mad. I decided to take away those wax feet tomorrow. I would tell him that I had done so, and that they had unfortunately been lost. His obsession would vanish then, I was sure. Going over to the cabinet, I slipped them into my waistcoat pocket and closed the door. What happened to the man whom you thought was a caretaker? I asked casually, as I stood up to go. It was 10 to 12. My uncle glanced up at the Nawab's picture. I suppose he went back to hell, he said, and opened the door to go into the hall. Coming down the stairs, as though their wearer was running, we both heard the sound of the anklet bells. Instinctively, my hand shot to my waistcoat pocket. It was empty. The feet, gasped my Uncle Harvey, and fell dead. Undesirable Guests by William Carleton. Matthew and Julia Brooke were a busy couple. They had a house in London and a house in the depths of Derbyshire, and traveling between the two would alone have sufficed to keep them occupied. Matthew worked in London as a partner in a firm of investment managers, and the house in Derbyshire was a shooting lodge from which he farmed an extensive, if not very productive, tract of moor. Julia lectured in London on the history of art, and in Derbyshire when the rain stopped, attempted conventional but occasionally saleable landscape paintings. Unemployment then was not a problem for them. Neither was childlessness, since they had two young girls of school age and a boy just emerging from babyhood. They had a full social life. In London, they gave and attended many dinner parties. The remoteness of their Derbyshire house was a deterrent to no one but themselves. No sooner had they taken possession of it than friends whom they had not seen for years, settled in places as far away as Hong Kong and Venezuela, came posting back to England to inspect it. As for the relations, and they had plenty of those on both sides, they seemed to spend the whole year queuing to come, and much bitterness was generated if anyone jumped the queue. Take, for instance, the Christmas which had just passed. For Christmas itself, they had Julia's parents, her unmarried elder sister, and an Italian lady with whom Julia had been at school, who had subsequently married and then been divorced from an alcoholic, and who was now recovering from a nervous breakdown. Before this not ideally assorted party, they had had Matthew's grandmother, who nearly died of a bad cold, and a modern historian who made love to their mother's help. The mother's help left in a huff, an annoying thing to happen just before Christmas, but not wholly unexpected, since mother's helps were among the things they most invariably lost when traveling between London and Derbyshire. For the new year, they had been expecting the Fieldings, a congenial family with children the same age as their own. But the Fieldings had called off at the last moment. It was not to be supposed, however, that this would give them several days to themselves, since the demands of their Derbyshire neighbors were still unappeased. When Julia first went from Ladbroke Grove to Derbyshire, she imagined that one of the advantages of their country house would be that they would not have any neighbors. She could not have made a greater mistake. The fewness of the local inhabitants in places like Derbyshire made them fasten the more avidly on any pleasant newcomer, and Julia found herself receiving and having to return invitations from a friendly but unsophisticated aboriginal population who all seemed to have the same names, and whose relationship to one another was intensely important to themselves, and very hard for anyone else to master. Thus the Dodsons of Battlegate were no relations to the Dodsons of the Dean, except that Mrs. Dodson of Battlegate had been a Miss Dodson of the Dean. On the other hand, the Englebys of Stillburn were quite closely related to the Englebys of Hando, but were at feud with them, and the Englebys of Engleby were not in fact the Englebys of Engleby. The impoverished Englebys of Drinkbottle were that. The Englebys of Engleby were another branch of the Stillburn family. As for the Drinkbottles of Dulwich Castle, they were a parvenu family, not really Drinkbottles at all. One thing which Julia clearly understood was that there had been no genuine Drinkbottles since the 16th century. "Don't forget," said Julia the morning after they had dispatched her Italian friend, "that we are having dinner with the Englebys tonight." Matthew had forgotten. "Can't we put them off?" "We've put them off twice, and they gave us a choice of every day this week." Matthew continued with his correspondence. "Look at that," he said suddenly, holding out a letter. "Now we're in real trouble. Now the ceiling's falling in. Seraphim Juris is coming tonight." "Oh, no. Can't we put him off?" "Quite impossible. We don't know his address, and anyhow, he'll be already on the way."
"He can't be. How could Seraphim be so inconsiderate?"
"Look and see for yourself." Julia took the letter. Seraphim Juris was an old friend whom Julia nevertheless regarded with some mistrust. His name was at once suitable and deceptive. As a boy, Matthew had first known him at school. He had looked like an angel, but was already one of the fallen tribe, and his beautiful but reckless appearance was a fair reflection of his personality. From an early age, he had formed a habit of doing exactly what he liked. This habit had led him to his early departure first from school, subsequently from Oxford, and eventually from England. In recent years, he had been heard of in a succession of very out-of-the-way places where, it was supposed, obstacles to doing what he liked were still few. His letter was dated from Lima in the first week of December, which suggested it was not wholly his fault that they had not had more notice. "My dear Matthew," began, "I shall be in England at the end of this month, and I am going up to visit my aunt at Arvin. Could I possibly stay with you on the night of the 30th? I know you'll be in your beloved Derbyshire then, and I know how Julia's marvelous hospitality can always stretch the house to hold one or two extra people. I am not sure if you heard of my marriage, which was a quiet affair. Mercedes is with me, and I'm eager for you to meet her."
"My God," said Julia. "It's not just Seraphim, but his wife."
"Read on," said Matthew grimly, "and see what he says about her. You don't know half of it yet." "She looked after me wonderfully last year," Julia read, "when I was sick in the mountains, and I really owe my life to her. Even now I'm afraid you'll find me pretty much of an invalid, but Mercedes gets me everything I need. I'm sure you will like her. She is an Indian and knows more about Indian customs than ever gets into the anthropological books."
"No, that's enough," said Julia, handing back the letter. "Seraphim's an invalid, and the wife's an Indian. Do you think she speaks English?"
"Broken Spanish, I expect. But that's all right, my love. You speak Spanish. You can hear about the Indian customs while she's getting Seraphim his special food."
"Special food?"
Julia had a horror of visitors who needed special food.
"It doesn't say anything about special food."
"I thought it was implicit, but perhaps he was referring to urine bottles or portable oxygen tents. Seraphim must be in a bad way if he describes himself as an invalid. In fact, I thought his handwriting looked shaky."
"I don't believe it," said Julia. "But look here, Matthew, what about the Inglebys? I don't want to cancel our dinner with them. Why should we, when the Dearnesses come down on us without any warning at all?"
"Well, you needn't. If they're coming at tea time, they can babysit, and we can let Mrs. Dodson off. Mrs. Dodson was the wife of the Brooks shepherd and lived about a mile away. They had no servants, thanks to the modern historian living in the house, but Mrs. Dodson herself was at their disposal when they were in residence. Days are short in Derbyshire at the turn of the year, and today darkness started to gather immediately after lunch."
"It looks like snow," said Matthew.
"I don't think so," said Julia. "It's very mild."
"I don't like the color of the sky," said Matthew. "It was, in fact, an unhealthy grayish yellow. We shall have rain turning to snow when it gets dark. We don't want to go out to the Englebys and find we can't get back."
The Brooks house was at the end of a long private road, which in turn was at the end of a narrow and indifferent public road, running partly across empty moors and partly along a high, unpopulated valley. It was often cut off for several days in winter, but seldom before January. Julia appreciated that there was some risk, but said that they could not cry off their engagement while the temperature was still so high. "If there's really snow about, the Dearnesses will meet it in Lancashire, and they stay in a hotel, and then we'll have the excuse that we can't leave the children." For a while it looked as if this excuse might materialize. Night fell, the hour for tea came and went, and there was no sign of the self-invited guests. In order, however, that they might still be able to attend their dinner if the Dearnesses arrived, Matthew and Julia fed their older children, settled Henry the youngest for the night, and started to change into evening clothes. They were still changing when they heard the arrival of a car. One of the reasons why Matthew had been less dismayed than Julia by Seraphim's letter was that he was very curious to see Seraphim's wife. He could remember a fairly rapid succession of women in Seraphim's life, and although they had sometimes been deficient in intelligence, education, breeding, good character, and even sanity, they had all been extremely striking to look at. He wondered what overread or primitive Eve-like figure Seraphim had found in South America. He was disappointed. Mercedes Dearness was a woman of middle age, dressed in black like any respectable South American matron, and she spoke tolerable English. If the blood of the Incas ran in her veins, it showed only in a certain squareness of figure and woodenness of visage. Having shaken hands with Matthew and Julia in a matter-of-fact way, she devoted herself to unpacking the car in which they had arrived and looking after her husband. As for Seraphim himself, he was indeed something of an invalid. The angelic or diabolical light had left him. Julia was in such a hurry to be off, and Mercedes was so much to the fore that they hardly saw him, but Matthew remarked on his changed looks as they drove away, "Seraphim looked in very bad form. I've never seen anyone so white." "I hope," said Julia, "he's not going to collapse on us and be unable to leave tomorrow." The Brooks were happy to be used as a hotel, but they did not like, as happened all too often, being used as a nursing home. They said they were definitely going on. "What did you make of all that stuff they had in their car? It looked as if Seraphim was carrying his coffin round with him." I expect it's the oxygen tent you were telling me about. His wife seemed very efficient at looking after him.
Yes, I got the impression that she was competent. It makes me happier about leaving the children with him.
Had you been worried then?
Well, Seraphim isn't a conspicuously responsible fellow, and you wouldn't know what sort of wife he might have picked up, though he did say Mercedes was capable of nursing.
Julia did not reply, and Matthew glanced at her.
You look as if you still have reservations.
Oh, she said, I'm sure she can cope. It's just that she's so much not Seraphim's type.
I suppose it really is Seraphim?
What an extraordinary suggestion.
Of course it's Seraphim. Who else could it be?
But I do wonder what exactly is wrong with him. Matthew's train of thought was interrupted by snowflakes on the windscreen.
There you are, he said. The rain's turning to snow.
It won't lie, said Julia. Besides, we've got the shovel in the back. You can never get completely stuck if you've got a shovel.
They had not had time before they left to do more than show their guest where they were sleeping and explain that there was food on the hot plates in the dining room. Their two older children were in bed and their youngest was already asleep. The dinner was set out on the hot plate, was inviting, and would not improve by being kept. It would not have been natural then for their guests, provided, of course, that they did not require anything special in the way of diet, perhaps after a few minutes in their room, to go to the dining room and eat. But that was not quite how they acted. Seraphim had emerged from the car in an even more decrepit figure than the Brooks, and the darkness of the night and the haste of the departure had properly realized. He had not gone up with his wife to see their room, but she had deposited him in the hall, where the only sign of life he gave was a slow mutter of apology for coming so suddenly and being so ill. When the Brooks had left, Mercedes picked him out of the chair, more like a life-sized doll than a human being, and took him into the kitchen. Not long afterwards, a loud shriek rang through the house. The two Brooks daughters, Lucy and Amanda, slept in the same room. They had not yet gone to sleep, and this cry alarmed them. It sounded like their brother Henry, of whom they were both very fond, but did not come from his room, which was a couple of doors away and opened into their parents' bedroom. They wondered what they should do, and after some consultation, pattered down the passage and looked into Henry's room. He was not there. They turned round to find the visiting lady watching them from the top of the stairs.
"Were you looking for the little boy?" she asked pleasantly enough. "He had a bad dream, and I have taken him down to the kitchen to give him some hot milk."
"May we come too?" asked Amanda, the youngest sister.
"No, you could get cold. You must go back to bed. The little boy will be all right in a moment, and then he will go back to bed too."
The girls returned to the room, but they were not reassured. The cry they had heard had not been the sort of cry a child emits in its sleep. It had the unmistakable urgency of waking terror. Neither was the reason given why they should not come down. That they could get cold in the kitchen, at all convincing.
"I think Henry's hurt himself," said Lucy. "The visitors are looking after him," said Amanda. But Lucy was nearly 9 and had a sense of responsibility. She was not prepared to leave things in the visitors' hands.
"I think Mummy and Daddy ought to be told."
"But how can they? They've gone out to a party. We could telephone to them."
Amanda did not like that suggestion. Ringing up parents at a dinner party is not something children are encouraged to do. Instead of voicing this real objection, Amanda said, "The lady told us to go to bed. What if she saw us?"
"She won't see us if we use the telephone in Mummy's room."
In the end, Lucy brought Amanda to agree to this. They managed to gain the telephone by their parents' bed unobserved, but unfortunately they did not know the right number.
"You must look it up in the book," said Amanda.
Lucy had never looked up a number before, and she had no real chance. The name Engleby may sound uncommon, but it is not uncommon in Derbyshire. When Lucy at last found the right page, she was confronted by several columns of Englebys, and she did not know to which of them her parents had gone. She tried dialing the first number, but it was not the right one. And in any case, she had omitted the dialing code, and therefore received only a dismal whine. The two girls were discussing what to make of this when they were interrupted by the voice of the visiting lady.
"What, playing with telephones?" she asked reproachfully.
"I thought you were in bed."
"We were ringing up Mummy."
"But don't you know that children must never ring up their parents when they are out at parties?" The girl's face showed that this shot had gone home.
"But do not look so sad," the visiting lady said. "I will take it so that you can play with a telephone, and it will not disturb your parents or cost any money."
The wire from the telephone ran to a little box on the skirting board under the bed. The visiting lady took the wire and pulled it out of the box as easily as you might pull off a thread that was hanging out of a piece of material. "Now," she said, "you can telephone." The lady's movement had frightened the children. "We don't want to telephone any more," said Lucy. "Besides, it won't work now." "Yes, it will," said the visiting lady. "Try it and see." "It can't work," said Amanda, "because you've broken the wire." "Why don't you lift the receiver and try?" the lady repeated. Reluctantly, Amanda took the receiver off its rest. As soon as she had done so, she heard a voice. It was not like an ordinary voice, more like one of those recorded messages, which you tend to get when you ring up the electricity board to complain about a power failure. "Your parents have gone away now," she said, and there followed a sound like a laugh. Amanda dropped the receiver and started to cry. "She doesn't like this game," said Lucy. "I think we'll go to bed now." Even if the children had succeeded in ringing up the right angle B's, they would not have been able to speak to their parents, since their parents were putting to the test Julia's theory that one can never get completely stuck if one has a shovel. The rain had turned to snow with a vengeance and was being driven across the moors by a howling wind. To begin with, it had merely swirled before their headlights, reducing visibility to a few yards and forcing them to slow down to 20, to 15 at times, to 10 miles an hour. But the slower they went, the more time they gave the drifts to build up, and they soon found themselves bumping over ridges of snow and feeling snow scrape the bottom of their car. Eventually, they ran into a drift, and they could not drive through. They got out and put on their boots to start digging. It was extremely cold, and the snow was building. "I don't like this," said Julia. It would not do for them both to lose heart, and Matthew's spirits rose to the occasion. "It's a dirty night, but it's fun to be out on it. This drift isn't much. We'll be through it in no time. Do you think we ought to turn back?" "That would be defeatist. If we don't turn back now, we shan't get back tonight. There'll be no hope of getting back from Stillburn. And then what about the children and the Jernises?" "They'll look after each other. Lucy's a sensible girl, but the fact is, I'm not sure we could get back now if we tried. The drifts are piling up all the time, and we're over the highest part of the road now. It would be easier to go on than back." Matthew was certainly right on this last point. In another mile or so they would be off the moor and might hope to be below the worst of the snow. Both of them contrasted in their minds the certainty of warmth and hospitality at the Englebys' house with the risk of having to spend the night in their car somewhere between their present position and their home. Such a night could be very unpleasant indeed, though perhaps no worse than the night on which Lucy and Amanda were launched. After the episode of the telephone, they had returned to their room, but there was no question now of their settling to sleep. "I wonder when Mummy and Daddy will come back," said Amanda. "Let's watch from the window." The room looked down the valley, and on a fine night it was possible to see approaching headlights far away, but tonight, of course, all they could see was snowflakes. After a while, they turned away from the window. "I don't like it here," said Lucy. "We don't know these visitors. Let's get dressed and wait for Mummy and Daddy with the Dodsons." "What, go out of the house by ourselves?" asked Amanda dubiously. "We could get out by the back stairs and the kitchen door." "What would Mummy say?" "We'll say we went out because we couldn't get to sleep." This was a regular excuse for irregular behavior at night. Amanda did not criticize it, although it was obviously thin, and neither child made any reference to their brother Henry. They succeeded in getting some clothes on, but not in stealing out by the back stairs. Seraphim was standing outside their door. "I thought you might not have gone to bed yet," he said. There was some color in his cheeks now, and his voice was much stronger than it had been when he arrived. "How late you stay up? Would you like a game?" "We were just going to bed now," said Lucy. "And why shouldn't you have a game? Your parents won't be back tonight. It's snowing too hard. Have you ever played Devil in the Dark?" "No. It's a game for winter nights. All the lights are put out, and one person is devil and has to catch the others. The others try to run away from him. I'll be devil. You'll find it quite exciting. Mummy doesn't like us playing games after she said good night to us." "Ah, but she won't know, will she, what we do tonight. Besides, it's too late now. My wife is just going to put out the lights." He had hardly finished speaking before all the lights went out. "Now," came Seraphim's voice with a laugh, "which of you can I catch first?" The laugh sounded just like the sound they had heard over the telephone. The children started to run. It was very late when, after digging through many snowdrifts, Matthew and Julia reached Stillburn. Dinner was over, and in the large hall lit by shaded lights, some people were playing cards, and others sitting round the blazing fire. Rupert Engleby came up and greeted them with warmth and some relief.
"Well done. I rang up to hear if you were coming, but the line must be down in your part of the country. I couldn't get a ringing sound. You must be in a dreadful state. There's food waiting for you. But what would you like to start with? Hot whiskey toddy? Ordinary whiskey? I'll get some."
"You'll stay the night with us, of course," said his wife, who had risen from the card table.
"What about the children? Is Mrs. Dodson with them? She'll be able to cope."
"She'll have to," said their host, coming up with a whiskey. "You couldn't possibly get back in this weather."
Matthew took his glass and drank gratefully and deep.
"As it happened, at Durness's, some friends of ours turned up unexpectedly and are spending the night, so Mrs. Dodson is all right."
"Is that Lord Durness?"
came a voice from one of the card players, a stout, very clean-looking man in a green smoking jacket. Matthew thought he recognized in him one of the heavier Derkshire neighbors, a Dodson of the Dean, perhaps, or one of the spurious drink bottles.
"Yes, do you know him?"
"I met him in Bolivia last year, an extraordinary fellow. He was living with a native woman."
"He seems to have married her. She's with him now."
"Better him than me. She struck me as a most unattractive lady, and she had a very queer reputation."
"Really?" asked Julia. "What for?"
"You'd never believe it. When I was staying at Cochabamba, the chief of police, who I found a very decent fellow, whatever some people may say. There's a lot of nonsense gets into the English papers about the Bolivian police. The spurious drink bottle looked around aggressively to see if anyone would dispute this."
"Go on," said Matthew. "What sort of reputation?"
"As I was saying, the chief of police told me that one of the chief troubles they have in the mountain villages is vampirism." There was some mirth at this, and the speaker flushed. "You may laugh, but I can tell you it's no joke to the villagers to have their children disappearing. Anyhow, this woman was suspected of having inclinations that way. I dare say there was nothing in it, but if I'd been Jurness, I shouldn't have cared to let her get her teeth into me. Ha ha." This time the laughter was confined to the spurious drink bottle. It was thought that the joke, though harmless, was a little ill-timed.